This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the second day of the New News Festival. My name's Margaret Simons. I'm Director of the Centre for Advancing Journalism. We put on the New News each year in partnership with Swinburne University and the Wheeler Centre. The subject of today's panel is very closely tied to the reasons we hold the New News Festival. We are living through an absolutely fundamental change in the way societies inform themselves and organise themselves. And it's open to debate whether this is a good thing, a bad thing, or a mixture of the two. But if we think back to the last enormous technological and social transformation, the Enlightenment, in Western Europe, which followed the invention of the printing press, which led to the invention of mass media, if we think about the period before that, people use terms like dark ages. Those of you who have read Hilary Mantel's novel, for example, Wolf Hall, will know that people were unsure what was true and what was myth. Were there really headless monsters coming down from Scotland and approaching London or not? People didn't know what was happening. If you're of a pessimistic frame of mind, you might see some comparisons in the rise of Donald Trump and the difficulty of knowing what is a fact and what isn't a fact, even when things such as where Barack Obama was born are about as verifiable as facts get. Now, I'm an optimist by nature, but nevertheless, we are living through a period when journalism is both under threat and also full of opportunity. It's a worrying change in the way Western democracies in particular organise themselves and inform themselves. And this morning, we're here to talk about whether journalism matters and how it matters. Now, this is actually a really complicated question, and what we're reporting on today is a research project which all of the people on stage with me today have been involved in over the last couple of years, called the Civic Impact of Journalism Project. And it was funded by industry, funded by people who know journalism, who understand its impact, and who believe it matters, and who are profoundly worried about what's happening. The very fact you're here at 9:30 on a Friday morning means that you probably share at least some of these concerns. But if you go looking for empirical evidence, substantial evidence of the sort that you might take to governments or to philanthropic funders or to NGOs about how journalism matters, it's actually a really complicated question, and the evidence is pretty thin on the ground. And so what we've done is a range of case studies, some of which are still in progress, looking at different kinds of journalism, because very early on we realised that there was a difference between, say, investigative journalism and the routine reporting of parliaments and the courts, for example. There's a difference between how journalism plays out in different geographic locations, such as country towns compared to the city. And there are also emerging opportunities for voices to be heard that weren't there previously. One example that we spent a good deal of time studying is Indigenous media and how Indigenous people are using new media in creative ways. Now, we're not going to talk about that very much today, though it is one of our important findings and the cause of ongoing research. We're not talking about it very much this morning because we have a dedicated panel on this subject later this afternoon, which I hope you'll come to. So let me introduce our panel. On my far left, we have Rod Tiffin, who is Emeritus Professor of Government and International Relations at Sydney University. To his right, we have Dr. Andrea Carson, who's a lecturer in the School of Political Sciences at Melbourne University, and also a journalist. Then we have Dr. Dennis Muller, who's a Senior Research Fellow with the Centre for Advancing Journalism, same place I come from, and also a former editor and journalist. And then immediately on my left, we have Professor Helen Sullivan, who is the founding head of the Melbourne School of Government at the University of Melbourne. Now, all these people coming from a mixture of political science and journalism backgrounds have applied a great deal of thought to how we actually look at how journalism matters and why it matters, and then to actually doing the case studies. And we're going to report today on what our findings. Being a journalist, I can't help but give you the lead first of all. Contrary to what some people may expect, we haven't found that investigative journalism has disappeared or even declined. In fact, you could argue that investigative journalism is having a little bit of a golden age. Maybe it won't last, but that's what's happening, seems to be happening at the moment. But what we are finding is that what I call the Journal of Record reporting, the sort of reporting which marked out the birth of the great newspapers of the world, such as the Washington Post, New York Times, The Guardian, and in Australia, The Age, Sydney Morning Herald, and so on, The Argus. The idea that an informed citizen could pick up a journalistic outlet and know everything that they needed to know to be effective as a citizen. We're losing that. We're losing the reporting of courts and parliaments. That seems to be the thing which is most under threat. And also, as I referred earlier, there are also emerging opportunities for voices to be heard that weren't being heard before. But enough from me, because I don't want to give away all the story. We're going to start off with Professor Helen Sullivan, who's actually going to talk about how you look at this question, this very complicated question of journalism in society. Over to you, Helen.
Thanks, Meg. And it's a great delight to be here. It's an odd thing being a political scientist amongst a research group of people who are expert in something other than what you might like to think yourself expert in. And it does mean that you both have the opportunity to ask the obvious question, you know, why do you believe that? Why do you think that? What's the basis for that? But it also means that your colleagues will sometimes look at you as if you've just landed from Mars because you apparently don't know the first thing about the things that they think are fundamental to what they do. And I'm starting there because I think that's part of the question for all of us when we try to respond to an issue like, does journalism matter? Why does it matter? Because for so many people, and I guess for people in this room, it's a given. Of course it matters. And you know in yourself why it matters. You feel very confident that it matters. Might not quite matter in the way that you think it should, but you have a fundamental belief that it does. But outside of that space, that's not the case. So how do we think about approaching a question like that from the point of view of doing some research that is going to be convincing to people? Because after all, that's what the people who are funding the research are interested in. What evidence is there, one way or the other, that is going to be convincing to people who make decisions, or indeed people who benefit from journalism, whether they recognise it or not? And so the questions that I was asking the team when we were thinking about this was, if we're talking about civic impact, then typical academic response, what do we mean by civic? What do we mean by impact? Those are important questions. We've had a lot of discussions about both of those words, won't surprise you. People have very different ideas about not necessarily the core meaning of those words, but certainly the emphasis they would put on what kind of impact, for whom, in what circumstances? And is civicness something that is individual as well as collective? And if so, what does that look like? And what on earth has that got to do with journalism? So lots of conversations about the meaning of words and how we might elaborate that. And that matters because that then takes you into the space of, well, if we can identify two or three core things that are associated with what we think of as civic impact, then we can begin to draw out from that an approach to how we might explore that in this broad field of journalism. And as Meg's already indicated, the team did quite a bit of work figuring out what different categories might look like in terms of where you might look for answers to some of these questions. So I'm not going to talk about that. But what I am going to talk about just a little bit more is how we then explored that. We emphasised case studies. For lots of people, and again, it's understandable, for lots of people, the idea of identifying impact is all about a big number. You know, can you give us a big number that we can use to convince politicians or whoever that it matters? Well, you could, but I'm not quite sure what it would tell you. I mean, big numbers tell you things like how many newspapers are sold, who listens to radio news, whether that's declined or increased over time. These are great and important things, but they don't really tell you much about the why of that. Why do people listen? Why do people read? Why do people care? And that then takes you into what we would call case studies. So in-depth studies of what happens, when, why it matters, or why it is perceived not to matter, And how it happens. And those questions are fundamental questions. They're deceptively simple questions, but they're all important questions to understanding whether journalism has an impact, and if it does have an impact, who does it impact on, for how long, and in what circumstances. And so our case studies have tried to explore those questions. Who's impacted, in what circumstances, over what period of time, with what consequences. And from those case studies, we're hoping to draw out some key lessons, which Meg's already given an indication of, that will point us in the direction of, if we think that journalism matters, then what might we be doing to develop its capacity in a changing world? So this research, as far as I see it, is both about demonstrating significance now in the context of civicness and what we think that is, but also what can we take into the future, into this changing world where we can all be journalists and we can all report to the news as we understand it. How can we take what we've done in our research to inform better practice in the future?
Thanks very much, Helen. So we're now going to get into some of the meat of the case studies, and Dennis went to Newcastle and looked at the impact of a particular piece of investigative journalism.
Thanks, Margaret. The case that I looked at was the work of Joanne McCarthy, a reporter on the Newcastle Morning Herald, in disclosing the extent of the cover-up within the Catholic Church of clerical sexual abuse of children in the Maitland Newcastle Catholic Diocese. And the reason that we chose that case study was that it had good conclusive boundaries around it. We knew the timeline. We were able to discover exactly the sequence of events, what McCarthy did, what the newspaper did, what others, police, lawyers, politicians did, and in the end, we were able to adduce evidence about the role that McCarthy's work played in the establishment of the Royal Commission, and we have evidence from Julie Gillard to that effect. What the case study revealed to me, and I speak as a former founding editor of the Sydney Morning Herald's investigative team, was that the good old-fashioned kind of journalism which has sustained and in fact has been the basis of investigative journalism for at least the last 30 years, those practices are still alive and they're still vital. And they are basically the qualities of perceptiveness, persistence, resilience and determination. And McCarthy showed all of these. It all started for her way back in 2005 when she was sent to cover a routine sentencing hearing of a Father James Patrick Fletcher in the Gosford District Court. He'd been convicted of sexual abuse of a child. She was the Gosford reporter. She was just sent by the paper to do this routine court coverage. And she just filed a couple of pars and went back to her normal work. Well, a few weeks later, she was asked by the chief of staff of the newspaper to look into a story about why enrolments in Catholic primary schools in Newcastle, Maitland, were falling. And she said to me, the story sounded to me as boring as batshit. And you can really understand why. But she began to look into this and just did good, basic journalistic work. She went back into the files. She saw that there were stories written in the Herald that had challenged claims by the hierarchy in Newcastle that that Fletcher and another guy whose name I can't give you were just rogue priests, and this had been challenged by the diocese. She went back and looked at the clips. She spoke to a guy called Bernard Barrett, who runs an outfit called Broken Rights, which is an advocacy group for the victims of child sexual abuse. He put her in touch with a lawyer in Newcastle who dealt with a lot of compensation claims. The lawyer obtained the release from her client, and she showed her a lot of the documents. And out of all of this, a picture began to emerge for McCarthy. So then she does the next important thing. She talks to police. And eventually she puts together a story which she described as a watershed. She described what she'd found. She described these compensation claims. Lots of them had non-disclosure provisions attached to them. And she said when she published that story, it was a watershed. Then victims began to come to her in large numbers. And one by one, she started to tell their stories. They were deeply moving, very harrowing stories. And they, in turn, as each new victim came forward, it tended to empower other victims to come forward. And so this kind of snowball effect began to happen. And the Newcastle Herald, to its very great credit, kept publishing this stuff. Now, let me tell you, from a long experience as a newspaper executive, you have a very short attention span as a journalist. And Joanne said to me, they did begin to get pedophile priest fatigue. But nonetheless, they stuck with it. And the editor at the time decided that they would put a label on these stories, and that was called Shine the Light. And at that point, it became partly investigation and partly campaigning. McCarthy just kept at it. She, in 2008, the Pope was coming here for World Youth Day. She rang the Vatican to say, will he apologise? He just apologised to the Americans in Boston. What about apologising to us? And she said, a very sniffy Italian voice said she should ring the Papal Nuncio in Australia. At any rate, she kept at it through the Bishops' Conference in Australia, and she said, I needed one bishop to crack, and he did. And then the Bishops' Conference in Australia got behind the idea of a papal apology, and a papal apology ensued. All of this is happening whilst police are investigating, and she made contact with a detective, Chief Inspector Peter Fox, who had been driving the police investigations in the Hunter Valley, and with a Greens Upper House Member of Parliament in New South Wales called David Shoebridge, who had the shadow portfolio of Justice and Attorney General in the New South Wales Parliament for the Greens, and he had taken an interest in this because of what he saw as injustices in the court system, which enabled the Catholic Church not to pay compensation, what became known as the Alice Defence. He took an interest in this, and then victims started to come to him. And when they came to him, he would ask them for advice, and they all said, talk to Joanne McCarthy. So you can see how she began to be a kind of link. The police, lawyers, politicians, she began to connect the dots for them in ways that they, and create a picture that they in their own silos hadn't been able to see. Now, on top of that, she began to be able to refer victims to the lawyers. So she was performing a kind of a broker role at this point, much the same way as a guy called Nick Davies on The Guardian had done when he was revealing the extent of phone hacking by the News of the World. He began to put victims of the phone hacking in touch with the lawyers, the plaintiff lawyers who were getting compensation for that. So much the same sort of role. And ultimately, this work created a political climate in which the calls for the Royal Commission became irresistible. And finally, Julia Gillard called it. And on her last day in office, she wrote McCarthy a letter, a handwritten letter, commending her and acknowledging the essential contribution that she'd made to creating the climate within which the Royal Commission could be appointed in the teeth at that stage of opposition from many of the churches. So that's the story of that shows how investigative journalism can really create huge political change.
Thanks very much, Dennis. And I got a call on Dr. Andrea Carson, who's been looking, together with other members of the team, at rural Australia, rural and regional Australia, and the impact of the changes in journalism there. Andrea?
Thank you, Margaret, and thank you, Dennis. I always get a chill up my spine when I hear Dennis recount that story about the magnificent work of Joanne McCarthy, which had real societal consequences and is one of the functions of journalism to expose wrongdoings or abuse of power. But what I've been looking at as part of this wider project is something you would all instinctively be familiar with, and that is how local journalism brings communities together and creates a connectedness. And there's been a long body of research that's seen the essential role traditionally that newspapers in particular have played in creating a sense of community and also a sense of nationalism. And I want you to think about your own media consumption habits. Perhaps what do you look at each day now? And then if you can remember, cast your mind back to maybe 5 years ago and the types of media you might have been looking at then. And I ask this question because 10 years ago I was a journalist at The Age, and back then that newspaper had 220,000 readers on the weekends. It would have half that now. When it had 220,000 readers, that was all Melburnians, Victorians coming together, reading the same sorts of stories, sharing in this common pool of knowledge. And community newspapers perhaps do that in a much more amplified way. Growing up in a rural community myself with the Colic Herald, which is an independent newspaper, everyone would read the tri-weekly paper and had a sense of who was getting married, who was... who had passed away, who was engaged, who had just given birth. It was very much the central voice. And one of the questions, and Helen's already mentioned, that we're trying to understand the impact of what the changes to media technologies and the commercialisation of media has on this particular sense of community building, particularly local papers. And some of the things that we know is that Australia obviously is a very vast geography. And with changes to the media models, as advertising has drifted online and as newspapers in particular have lost some of that advertising, and not only that, as it's drifted online and anyone can see some of that advertising, its unit prices began to fall. The way that media companies have responded to this has been to centralise their operations. That's meant closing down some of their rural networks and having them all work out of a larger regional centre. So we specifically put the focus on three areas: Moree, Broadmeadows, which is obviously an urban area but one that's quite disadvantaged and a discrete community, and Byron Bay. And what we found in particular was that, yes, changes to media organisations had led to fewer staff in newsrooms, not much commitment to training, and people working around the clock, or usually one or two people, trying to bring news to the local community and increasingly relying on press releases and other people to be able to deliver that information. That's the bad news that we found. The good news we found, of course, is that technologies also offer opportunities, and some of those opportunities are about being able to deliver information very quickly using social media, being able to crowdsource information and involve the audience in the storytelling. And there's been some studies in Belgium and also in Holland that look at this and have found that when you involve the community in the storytelling, you get a very different type of storytelling. You get one that is more focused on the human experience rather, and sometimes... perhaps pejoratively, this is called soft news rather than hard news, relying on police reports or reporting at a distance on what's happening in the criminal courts. But the upside to this, which we found particularly in Broadmeadows, is that that's a fairly disadvantaged community. It's very multicultural. It has lots of challenges, not much infrastructure compared to other urban areas. But what we found is that rather than the mainstream media telling the story of Broadmeadows, Channel 9, Channel 7, The Age, coming in there when usually there's a bad news story, local communities were able to take editorial control, use social media networks, particularly Facebook, some podcasting, and be able to tell their own stories their way. And community groups, neighbourhood houses that have contact with thousands, hundreds of thousands of their local members each year, were able to engage their local communities and get them to participate in the storytelling and to be able to tell the positive stories. We also found this to be true in Moree, where a long history there of, and Dennis spent some time there collecting this information, a long history of unrest between the indigenous communities and the white communities. And the local newspaper provided a voice to be able to bring those communities together and to make people feel more as one. In Byron Bay, it was there was some campaigning journalism that was occurring there against some of the blow-ins that were coming into those communities and doing some development that was very uneasy for the local residents. And the newspaper provided an advocacy role for people to be able to champion their cause against some of this urban development. So if we were to synthesise those three case studies and look at what the key opportunities were, it was being able to reach new audiences, bring local communities together, but also being able to reach audiences that are outside the geographical area. And this was important in Byron Bay in particular, because it's not just people living in Byron Bay that care about rampant urban development or seeing a seaside scape like that being transformed. And so other people were able to participate in this space. It's relatively cheap to be able to communicate using social media networks and being able to crowdsource, and some of that negates the shrinking newsrooms and the lost revenue that's coming. We also found that there was different types of narratives, being able to get around the editorial controls of mainstream media telling these negative stories, and for local communities to be able to tell their stories their way. Of course, there were challenges as well, and some of these challenges we found to be true of both the new environments of using social media as well as the more established traditional media networks, and that was sustainability. Someone needs to be able to put these posts up to disseminate this information, to bring together the content, and that costs money. It also takes time to make sure that you don't end up with negative commentary coming in and hijacking some of these sites with trolling. And so it needs a certain amount of vigilance, and that requires resources to do that. The other negativity, which can be seen as a positive in some aspects, particularly a place like Broadmeadows that has dozens of different languages being spoken in that area, is media fragmentation. And that is that you can reach very discrete audiences, which is great if you're trying to reach communities that might be Greek speakers or Macedonian speakers. But if you're trying to reach a large group of people all at the same time, it becomes a more delicate task and also an expensive one to go through all those individual channels to be able to reach a mass audience. And this leads on very nicely to Rod's area of expertise, where he's going to talk to us about some of the positives and negatives about this sense of the mass audience of coming together as a community.
Okay, yes, so Andrea's preface this. Rod is going to contextualise some of these findings, and then I want to talk briefly about the case study I did into court reporting in Melbourne and what's happening there. But I'll turn to Rod now.
Yes, it's a great pleasure for me to be... It's a great pleasure for me to be here at the 7th New News Conference, and I really think there's a wonderful vibe around the place with all the sense of innovation and energy and new possibilities going on. And I think one of Meg's aims in starting the whole thing was to create this oasis of optimism amongst the gloom. I therefore feel it's incumbent on me to inject some pessimism into the proceedings. And I'll ask you, what do you think has been the most successful media startup in the Western world in the last 20 years? And financially anyway, sadly, it's Rupert Murdoch's Fox News, founded 20 years ago this year. And now with revenues of $1 billion a year and the largest single profit-making part of the Murdoch empire. And then I want to track back a bit, and I wonder here if there's anyone in the audience who remembers Red Skelton. What discerning people you are. When I was in year four at Cheltenham Primary School down the road here, our weekly show and tell on a Tuesday morning consisted of half the class saying what great things had happened on Red Skelton last night, and the other half of the class saying what great things had happened on Phil Silvers or Sergeant Bilko last night. I should add that my year four at primary school was also year four of television in Melbourne. And by then, nearly everyone in our areas had TV sets in the house, and the novelty hadn't worn off. And it's a reminder in a way that television, more precisely free-to-air analogue terrestrial television, was the massest medium in history. And so at that time, a great majority of the population of Melbourne was watching TV that night. The sense of novelty hadn't worn off. And if you actually did the same exercise now, far fewer would have been watching TV. And even those who were watching TV in some form or other, their choices were much less constrained. You know, we had a choice of three channels. And television was, in many ways, a force for improvement in the coming decades. I won't go into all the reasons I think that, but let me give you a couple of statistics. In the US, the audience for the national TV network news, CBS, ABC, NBC, in the 1970s was 46 million people each night, or 75% of the people watching TV at that time. By 2005, that figure was down to 30 million in a much increased population. And the main loss of audience was to the much greater range of entertainment options. And in the meanwhile, you had the beginnings of the rise of cable news from then on. CNN, Fox News, MSNBC. So it's always said that Fox is the most, you know, successful, most watched cable news channel. But 1 to 2 people watch Fox at any time in an evening, which is still dwarfed by the free-to-air TV networks, 12 million of whom may be watching. So it's important not to overestimate the reach of Fox. But what we've got also is that for many people, Fox is their only source of news. It's not just a diminishing news audience, and the gap between information rich and information poor has become much wider. It's audience fragmentation, but it's also political polarisation. So Republicans, ardent Republicans, Trump voters, trust Fox and don't trust anyone else. And other people trust nearly everyone else and don't trust Fox. So we've got polarisation there too. And just as an aside, on total daily newspaper circulation density, that is sales as proportion of population, in 1950 in Australia it was around 43%. In 1984 it had dropped to 29%. And by 2014 it was down to 7%. So, as I said before, this gap between information rich and information poor is growing. Now, I'm not suggesting that we're moving to a Tower of Babel or anything like that, but we know, for example, that newspapers are still investing, and ABC is still investing in investigative reporting, but the outreach, the impact of it, is often less because the unified national public is not what it is, a thing of the past. Sometimes it works wonderfully, as in this most uplifting of case studies that Dennis has reported, but we're moving into times where I'm calling what I'm writing the mixed blessings of massness. And they were, the blessings were definitely mixed. I'm not going into all the downsides here. The monopoly gatekeepers, the voices excluded and all that sort of thing. But we are moving into uncertain times in terms of the role of journalists in enforcing democratic accountability.
Well, thank you, Rod, for that corrective to my naive Pollyanna-ish optimism. I'm just going to talk very
quickly. Which I'm sure will have a great effect on you.
Absolutely, yes. I'm depressed already. I'll go home and cry. But anyway, I'm going to report very briefly because I do want to allow time for questions from the audience on a case study I was involved in, which is currently being written up on court reporting in Melbourne. One of the functions that we distinguished when we were doing our early thinking through the methodology was the sort of boring, non-glamorous, non-Walkley Award-winning journalism of simply reporting on what's happening in the public forums of society, parliaments and courts. And so we decided to do a case study on exactly that, court reporting. Now, court reporting is a bit of a specialist area of reporting. It does take some particular expertise. There are all sorts of rules around court reporting, what can and can't be published, which you learn through experience mainly. In my case, I was thrown into the deep end in the Melbourne Magistrates Court when I was 20 and learnt by making lots of mistakes. But there is a community of court reporters who have that expertise and who have established relationships with lawyers and judges and who are well recognised around the court precincts. The other reason why this sort of reporting is important is it's actually a pivot in the idea of open justice and the relationship between the media and the law. And there are actually special protections written into law for court reports, with the idea being that open justice requires that the public are actually, in a practical sense, able to find out what's going on in the courts. And so there's defences in defamation law, for example, for accurate and fair reports of what's happening in certain public forums. So it's really one of the areas where the media is most recognised and most endorsed, if you like, by some of the other institutions of civil society. Now, broadly speaking, what we found is that dating from about the late 1990s, the numbers of court reporters have been reducing, and this has taken a real dive just in the last couple of years. And some of Melbourne's most experienced court reporters, people like Steve Butcher, for example, have retired. And this has a massive impact. On the one hand, the reporters who are reporting courts are fewer in number, but they're also much less experienced. And a whole load of informal training and mentorship that used to happen between the senior court reporters and the more junior ones is no longer happening. And the courts are aware of this. They're intensely sensitive to it. And they've responded to it. One of the ways they've responded is that suppression orders are more likely to be issued these days by judges because they don't necessarily trust the reporter who's in front of them to understand the rules of sub judice contempt, for example, and to understand what can and can't be published. Now, suppression order, of course, is a very blunt instrument. It is effectively a counter to the principle of open justice. And so that is a really significant impact. But the other thing that's happened, and again, this is over a longer period than just the last couple of years, is that the courts have stepped into the media space themselves. Now, this happens across a whole load of different areas. Some of you will remember when The Age used to publish the Daily Law List. That no longer happens because you can go onto the court's website and find it for yourself. But also the courts are increasingly publishing judgments and they're employing journalists to write summaries of judgments, and increasingly courts information offices, in some cases more than one per court, both to assist journalists to get information, recognising that the journalists will often not have been sitting in court but will be making a phone call or trying to gather information from the newsroom, or may have been in the court temporarily but wasn't there for the crucial bit. And so the courts are stepping into the situation of being their own advocates in media. And the court reporters we spoke to said it's now not possible to do the job of reporting the courts without the active cooperation of the court's information officers, who are often former journalists themselves. Now, this is both good and bad, I think. It's that the courts are not alone in beginning to use the capacities of new media to publish their own information. But one of the things we did find is that the judges and the journalists have a totally different idea of what open justice means. Both of them say it means that citizens should be able to find out what's going on in court, But journalists are more likely to say, well, it's important to keep the judges and the court system accountable. The judges and the court officers we talked about had to be prompted to come up with that response as part of open justice. And when we asked them for examples of when media reporting had helped to keep the courts accountable, they saw it entirely negatively. Any media criticism was seen as ill-informed, ill-based, and it would be better off if it hadn't happened at all. Whereas, of course, the journalists saw that as an important part of their function. So I think the concerning thing about this is that on the one hand, the courts have stepped up, have recognised the importance of the practical application of open justice, but we have lost a whole sort of informal information-sharing community around the courts precinct, which helps the public to be better informed about the courts. And the courts themselves are becoming more conservative about what they allow to be public at the same time as putting out basic information, and they have yet really to be tested on the accountability issue. If there is a scandal about a judge making inappropriate remarks or a case of rank injustice, would the courts assist reporters in reporting that? We haven't really had the test case on that. It is an area of real concern. And a very live debate among judges is how far the courts should go down this road. They already are active on social media. Judgments can be published. There has been some limited blogging by courts information officers about what's going on in the Supreme Court. And there has been discussion about whether it would be productive to hire retired judges to actually write commentary on the courts that would appear on the court's own website. And there is a great division of opinion about whether the courts should actually get into being the media. The other thing, which is harder to measure, is all the court's information that isn't being published. There are all sorts of really interesting civil cases in the federal court, for example, about disputes over the colour that that various brands are able to use, about the definition of a Fuji apple, for example, which would make really nice stories from a journalistic point of view, which simply aren't being reported at all. And again, crossing over with some of what Andrea was saying, local courts, magistrates' courts, suburban courts are not being reported at all, and the police are really concerned about that because, of course, it acts as a deterrent, the information about what happens to people who breach the law on a local level. So some really interesting examples of how when the media changes, the institutions of society, including those like the courts, which we might think of as very conservative and immutable, they change too. I think it's a really powerful example of how journalism can matter. Now, we haven't had time to talk about all we're doing. As I said, there's a whole branch of this project on Indigenous media, which was the subject of a roundtable here yesterday with many Indigenous media people involved, and there will be a panel on that later this afternoon. And we've also done some work on campaigning journalism and the impact of that, which we haven't had time to talk about. But I've got my eye on the clock, and I'm hoping that some of you might have some questions. So feel free. If you don't have questions, I've got a few. So do we have a question?
My question is the media volume, particularly in the US, it's sort of never mind the quality, feel the width, and in the sense that the US election coverage, there are so many things that aren't being covered, like incarceration in America, where it's the highest incarceration rate in the world, yet all we get is gossip about why Hillary is better than Donald, and it's just rubbish. So some reflections perhaps from the panel. Is that happening here in Australia? Thank you.
I'll have a bash at that if you like. I'm sure my fellow panellists have got things to say on it as well. Or do you want to go first, Rod? You can give the pessimistic view.
Well, I think it's always been the case in election campaigns that the media are first and foremost guided by what the parties are making the issues. And if neither of the main parties is making something an issue, it's rare for it. It might be dramatised by some awful event or something like that, but it's the nature of election campaigns that there's lots of important issues that are never debated. I think that this particular Trump-Clinton campaign has been, because of it's such a polarising campaign, has posed a lot of the issues for the media on all sides. And for example, I've been told the New York Times went through a long editorial process in which they first said they could, in their norms of objectivity, call stuff that Donald Trump had said was a lie, and then actually put the word lie in a headline on the front page. And this was sort of went through quite an agonising process before they decided that. But you're quite right. But it's not just this election campaign. In many election campaigns, a lot of the biggest issues are omitted. Yeah.
Can I add a quick point about the role of polling and how that also affects the coverage of political coverage, particularly for newspapers, which in the past were the agenda setters, they had lots of resources, and they could provide unique journalism. But many of the advantages that they've had have now been taken over by the breadth and speed with which electronic media and social media can also deliver news. So one of the way that newspapers have tried to regain that unique space is to commission these opinion polls. And opinion polls have proliferated, not just in America, but also in Australia. You'd be very aware of it in the last very long election campaign that we had here. And by their very nature, it means that the reportage becomes very horse race driven about who's in front this week, who was in front last week, what's the difference. And by talking about the personalities or the presidential style campaign, you're moving away from the policy agenda and of what is the points of difference in policy between these political parties, between these political leaders. And so that's just one of the fragments that explain some of this puzzle about why we get this very narrow focus of reporting.
Yeah, there's another thing, sorry, mate, go on.
One thing, again, sort of... It seems to be my role to be the optimist here. I'm not necessarily optimistic about this. I think it's a real concern. But one thing to watch, and it's changing really, really fast right now, is the aggregators of news. Yeah. Now, at the moment, we know that the majority of young people are getting their news through social media, through Facebook, for example. And the way those algorithms are drawn up is really opaque. Angela Merkel is reported just this morning as saying that, you know, this is one of the reasons for polarisation of politics in Europe, for example. Now, I'm not sure whether there's any really rigorous research that supports that, but it's certainly a real concern and a real question. But right now, and including here in Melbourne, there are just beginning to emerge a number of start-up aggregators which are billing themselves as providing you with the serious news without ads. You have to pay for it, but without ads. They've signed, and Inkle is one, and we've got some handouts from them on the tables at the back, where they've signed agreements with the Washington Post, the New York Times, The Age, The Conversation, you know, a huge range of media, and their promise to you, and I'm not spruiking for them, you can make up your own mind, their promise to you is that you will be get an aggregation of news which is not driven by some dumbed-down algorithm, not driven by the idea of you only wanting to hear opinions with which you agree, but would actually go back to that idea of the journal of record. Now, that's changing very fast. Inkle is only a couple of years old. It's only really just begun to operate. I think that's a really important space to watch, because I do think that the notion of journal of record is a really important one, and we need to reinvent it for the times.
Yeah, the particular... role of the American media in this election has been, I think, only recognised in that story that Rod referred to, where the New York Times finally decided to call Trump for what he was. Because up to that point, the American media had been along for the ride. Trump was great headline fodder. And they went along for the ride because it was good for ratings and good for sales. And finally, the New York Times and the Washington Post woke up to themselves far too late. I mean, it's been a pretty disgraceful performance by the American media on the whole.
Helen, do you want to?
Well, not being a journalist, but being a somebody who reads the news, I think I'm in the oasis of optimism on this from the point of view of. One of the things I think it has done is to expose, not that it really needed exposing, but expose just how far we still have to go on issues of gender equality. And that's an issue not just in the States. As you will all know, it's an issue here. And I think what it has done is to put into really stark relief how perhaps too comfortable some people have become with notions of progress. And so, you know, while it's all happened in the most horrible way, I do think it has served to remind us that we've still got a lot of work to do in lots of areas.
Okay, I'll take another question.
Morning, everybody. My question, I guess, kind of comes back to the sort of positive, negative, optimistic, pessimistic kind of line that you've drawn. But it strikes me that, like, it's not quite optimistic, pessimistic, because in a sense, kind of, what, you know, when you're talking about, you know, the court reporting, you're bringing a set of concerns there about the importance of why journalism matters and concerns about, you know, perhaps potential losses with the shifts, the shifts that you're talking about. But if we're thinking about court reporting, or we're thinking about local news, or we're thinking about investigative reporting, you know, as per the child abuse scandal, I guess they all sort of fall into what you might call public interest or kind of a public utility view of journalism, where the kind of policy implication then is that, okay, well, that might provide a basis for some sort of public or philanthropic or private funding to support that sort of journalism. Now, if I come to the sort of more negative perspective from you, Rod, it's that's when we're talking about civic impact there, we're talking about things like Trump, Hansen, we're thinking about, you know, perhaps, you know, the refugee policy in Australia and journalism's civic impact in feeding into those things. And so my question is, if that's your kind of perspective on civic impact, what's the policy implications or the policy message that might come out of that analysis?
Thanks for that simple question. I think that when we talk about digital revolution, you know, there's many of you probably know the Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter, who's said capitalism was marked by creative destruction, and the old practices, the old technologies are replaced. And in the end, it's better for the consumer and better for the corporations, and you get increases in efficiency. And there's a lot to be said for that in a lot of areas. And a lot of it's also true in journalism as well. But I also think it's very possible that it's going to leave some quite important market failures and things that the public needs and the market is not going to provide. And I think local reporting is one where this is likely to be the case. I mean, I think we're probably always going to have quite strong federal political reporting, at least of the parties, maybe not of the public service. There'll probably be a market for good business reporting. In Australia, sports reporting will probably always have a sizable market. But where there's cost of actually doing it, covering courts, especially the more minor courts, covering councils, I think there's going to be some need for public intervention to ensure quality and accountability. Now, there've got to be rules about how that public intervention is done. It's got to be done in a commercially neutral way and in a politically impartial way. But there are, so it's not all of a piece. And we've been keen to stress that in our project. You know, it's sort of, I think there would be scope, for example, not that it's likely to happen, I think there would be scope, for example, for government support for a local government news agency that gives material out to all who want it, to use as they want, and doesn't do investigative reporting, but expands the public record to show the debates that are going on in each area, and then the links between them, the links between beachside development in different councils or compiling databases and that stuff, and stuff like that. And this would be cheap, and it would be a boon to democracy, you know. So I do think that's just one example of where I think that there is scope for constructive policy involvement in these areas.
And in that context, I mean, hopefully some of you will be coming along this evening for the keynote speech by Michelle Guthrie, the new managing director of the ABC. I'll be very interested to hear what she says. But one of the things she's talked about in other contexts is building partnerships across platforms for ABC content so that it would be distributed, you know, pretty much open source. You know, maybe that's one direction in which ABC journalism might go.
Scott? I think there's another policy aspect here too. We're in the middle of debating changes to the 75% reach rule, which means that no license holder of broadcast can reach more than 75% of the population. Part of the trade-off for that has been an attempt, I think a very weak and insufficient one, to try to protect local reporting in regional areas. Now, the part of the problem is no one has defined what the word local means. So is it sufficient to broadcast out of Bendigo and say that's local for Warrnambool? So that's, I think, one of the overhanging issues that's really quite immediate for us.
We've got time probably for one more quick question, and the answers will have to be short as well, I'm afraid.
Activist area, there's a lot of argument about what Australia knows. So things like the Nauru files, there's a sense that, well, everyone in Australia knows now and they're making a decision based on information. Do you have any sense of how we work out, does Australia know anything in these sort of critical areas for policy?
Well, as somebody said to me yesterday evening in a different context, Australia is not a person. Australia is a, you know, a collection of individuals and a whole load of other things as well. So it's very hard to talk about what Australia knows. But again, it's a question of fragmentation, which has always been an issue. I mean, not everybody was reading The Age or The Argus, you know, 30 years ago. A lot of people were reading Truth. A lot of people weren't reading anything. But again, you know, I think if we're going to say, can we be sure that people know things in the future, we must watch the aggregators. We must watch the aggregators and what they do and how they do and how we as responsible citizens interact with that.
Can I, with the Nauru files, it's a long time coming. And the reason I say that is that asylum seeker policy in this country on both sides of politics, there's been a very deliberate strategy to keep the media at arm's length by having offshore processing. Media don't get access, we all know this. And as a consequence, our knowledge as a public about asylum seekers comes from elites, from politicians. Most of us do not meet asylum seekers face-to-face to be able to make judgments. We know through research and some of the work that I've done on public opinion research during election campaigns that Australians overwhelmingly have very negative attitudes towards asylum seekers. Where do those attitudes come from? They come from the political parties themselves that have... The coalition has been very consistent in a hardline approach to asylum seekers. Labor Party's moved around 180 degrees over the last 15 years on its asylum seeker policy. The consequence of this is that we end up with, out of the two major parties, very bipartisan support that's very hardline and has quite a negative framing of asylum seekers, moving away from a humanitarian frame into one that is about national security. What The Guardian has done has allowed Australians another perspective. And that's why I say it's a long time coming, because there's been such a difficulty for media to get access. Yeah. And those perceptions are going to take time to move. So when you ask about what do Australians know, and taking on board Meg's comments, these built-up perceptions that are very negative will take time to change, and that will require more media attention, not just a one-off hit.
I'm afraid we are out of time. But I do just want to point out that we have a session called Nauru Access and Control at 12:30 today. It's nearly booked out, so if you're interested in coming, book soon. It's free, like virtually everything at the New News. And that includes Paul Farrell from The Guardian, Chris Kenny from The Australian and Sky News, Wendy Bacon, and it's chaired by Jim Middleton. We've already had a request from Sky News to record it. It's going to be a fiery session. I'm glad Jim's chairing it, not me. But also, we're about to move into a session immediately after this one, starting at 11 o'clock, on branded content and native advertising. Something we've only touched on here is how do you pay for journalism? And increasingly, of course, with the advertising model that used to, in a fairly simple fashion, support journalism, broken or certainly under strain, the question is, what are we going to do? What are the new business models? And we'll be hearing there from Ian McClelland, also from The Guardian, Alan Williams from Fairfax, Raquel Abili from Newsmodo and Tim Duggan, that's chaired by Sophie Black. Then we have another session at 2 o'clock this afternoon about reporting on the Asia Pacific. As the big newsrooms shrink, what's happening to our capacity to actually understand not only our own country, but our region? We'll be hearing there from Mary Louise O'Callaghan, Liam Fox, Joe Chandler and Stefan Armbuster, and that's chaired by Dr. David Nolan. And then at 3:30, we'll be talking about future views and future news, experiments in storytelling. Are you all going to be watching virtual reality journalism wearing goggles on your head or something else? That's looking at the cutting edge of journalism. We've got Nick Evershed, Simon Creera from BuzzFeed, Stefan Armbuster again, and Alicia Sometimes, chaired by Sophie Black. And then the last panel, which I have already mentioned for the day, will be about Indigenous use of new media. We have Luke Pearson of Indigenous X, Michelle Lovegrove, Lisa Waller, Summer Mae Finlay, and chaired by the Centre for Advancing Journalism's own Jack Lattimore. And then at 6:30 tonight, we have the only paid event in the New News Festival, but it's very cheap, only $20. It will be the keynote address from the Managing Director of the ABC, Michelle Guthrie. That will be taking place in the Collins Street Baptist Church, and there are still tickets available. You'll need to go online to the Wheeler Centre website to book those. And tomorrow, of course, we have more, but I won't list it all. You've got the programme online and you can have a look. But thanks very much for being here. Please join me in thanking our panel, and buy the book when we write it.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.